Hello, Bill.
Hello, Matt.
It is steamy in the DMZ, DMZ South here. It's the humidity has finally made its way to Washington. How is it in Northampton?
It's been pretty rough the last 2 days, you know, over 90, very sticky, but it's coming down a bit today. And it's just, I think there's a lot of rain in the forecast, so
yeah
we never get as bad as Swampland does.
Yeah, well, it's aptly described that way. Now, you should know, though, Bill, and we should make the point that the D.C. enjoyed the coolest spring since 1996. So, but summer's off to a hot start. And, Bill, it's not just the temperature that's heating up out there, but it is also the politics. This is an amazing political
week. Wow.
Talk about a segue.
That is a segue.
as we, there are Supreme Court rulings to be handed down as we speak. So some of the things that we're going to talk about could end up becoming old news by the time you watch this. But here's something that I think will be talked about for days and weeks to come, Bill, and that is the new Crossfire. CNN bringing out Crossfire. We've just found out who the new hosts will be.
And they're hiring us? We're on TV again?
We are the Ceasefire, but that is Crossfire.
Ah.
And so,
close.
Yeah, we narrowly missed out again. Very close to landing our own CNN show yet again. I'm told that we were, narrowly edged out by Newt Gingrich. In your case, Van Jones was selected over you.
If I only built my own movement first.
Yes.
Well, then I might have gotten this show.
Think about it. SC Cup and Matt Lewis. What a pairing. And we could go up against Stephanie Cutter and Bill Scherer. That would be must-see TV. But alas, it was not to be. But I suspect that it may, it may come to their senses eventually anyway, and we could see that pairing.
So are you hopeful here? Is this going to be the great early days of Crossfire, the rich debate on TV, or is it going to be just another case of people yelling at each other and not really and just talking past each other, and cable TV descends another notch into the abyss?
Well, look, you can't recapture the golden days, because when Crossfire at its peak, it was a totally different world. The cable universe was totally different. There's no way that you'll go back to those, halcyon days. Having said that, I am excited about this. I think that Crossfire, they should have never gotten rid of it. It was still a very good show. I'm much more excited now. You're going to think I'm saying this because I'm a conservative, but I think I can legitimately say that SC Cup and Newt Gingrich are much more interesting than Van Jones, and especially Stephanie Cutter, whom frankly I'm not that impressed with. And I think that they did a much better job of hiring hosts on the right than they did on the left. Now, again, you may say that I'm biased there, but I'd love to get your take on that.
Well, I just think you have to see how they do. Van Jones had some CNN FaceTime, but I don't think he's really been seen as sort of carries a show before.
Yeah.
I mean, he's been more an activist than a media figure. And I know you're not a big fan of Stephanie Cutter in her time.
I just don't think she's
an Obama.
I just don't think she's interesting or comes across as all that, astute. Like, I don't know that she's ever said anything that really impressed me. I mean, and I try not to be biased ideologically here. I mean, I think that there are people that like Joe Trippi that I think are incredibly bright and interesting, and Paul Begala, I think is smart. Obviously, she has something going. I don't want to say that she's not right. Obviously, she has something going for her. I haven't found her a compelling TV figure, in my opinion.
I mean, they don't have Newt Gingrich is a whirling dervish of insanity, which is why he gets on TV a lot,
great
because I don't know what he's going to say next.
How can he host?
It's good for TV.
Will he be able to host? I mean, it's one thing that you can be a guest, but they're going to have guests on, presumably, as well. Can he host? That's a question.
Right. Can he not talk at some point? Can he let someone else talk and have a conversation? We'll see about that. And SC Cup, I think, is an interesting figure. We've talked about her on the show before. She has shown some desire to challenge some conservative orthodoxy. I think she talks in a different language than the conservatives of the Buckley generation. And, you know, Stephanie Cutter has been, you know, part of the Democratic Party apparatus more. You know, her history has been to be an on-message person. And Van Jones has been an activist person, right, with that short stint in the White House where he got drummed out over charged up being a 9/11 truther.
I have found Van Jones to be, during his CNN stuff, I have found him to be more intellectually honest than I would have suspected. I mean, he's obviously of the left, and that's fine. But I have found him to be more, you know, willing to call out both sides. So I think he'll be better. I will say this. I guess two things. One, I think Essie Cupp is the most interesting hire. So obviously she's leaving MSNBC.
Is she leaving The Blaze?
I don't know about that. Is she?
I don't know. I don't know.
Well, I think she's obviously she would have to leave her MSNBC show where she co-hosts The Cycle. So I think she's the most interesting person here. I think she'll be fabulous in this role. I think it's great for her. You know, now she's like one conservative, sort of a token conservative, surrounded by three or four liberals. Here it's going to be more parity. I think she'll do great. I think this elevates her star and will give her a real star power. I think she'll be fascinating and interesting. Kudos to her. I wish that Crossfire would stick to journalists, though, as opposed to Newt Gingrich and Van Jones and Stephanie Cutter. I mean, I liked it when they had people who were essentially, you know, journalists, like, you know, Tucker Carlson and Bob Novak. And I think Essie Cupp fits into that category as well. I would like to see them go that route, as opposed to people who like to stay on message and score political points. And that was that was the problem with Begala and Carville, and it could be the problem with Cutter as well.
What's something you don't know yet? Is Cutter making a decision? Because Begala and Carville sort of never left the game. You know, right. they were always political consultants. Right. And I don't know if Cutter is making a decision to leave that world and be in the media world and free yourself up. And is Van Jones leaving the activist world similarly to free himself up? And therefore, they're all going to be a little bit more loose.
Right.
This
is a great point, Bill. I mean, you know, there was a time when I had to decide when I thought I might become an operative, and I wanted to be a political operative at one point. And there was a time when, and by the way, this ties into your whole Howard Dean thing, because I started blogging because of Howard Dean and Joe Trippi, and they were doing it on a campaign. So that's sort of how I got into it. And then later, I decided to transition into, you know, exclusively into journalism. My wife, as you know, is still a political operative or a consultant. But I made that decision. And when I made the decision that I wanted to be in journalism, it was sort of like crossing the Rubicon, because I start to be interesting. You have to criticize people and say controversial things from time to time, things that you wouldn't do if you were worried about offending your next client or being, you know, if I thought I was going to run for political office down the road, there's a lot of things that I've said that could and would come back to haunt me. So it was really like crossing the Rubicon. And frankly, I think that, you know, it freed me up to be much more interesting and obviously intellectually honest. And I think that's my appeal to people. I mean, you know, probably not the best writer in the world. Maybe not the best sourcing in the world. I mean, there are people who have better sources. But I will try to be brutally honest and tell the truth about my side and every other side. So that's sort of a selling point. If Stephanie Cutter did that and decided she wanted to be a journalist, then she would be much more interesting than if she sort of in the back of her head thinks, well, but I'm still going to be consulting on the side, or I still have to be, you know, speak, you know, I may be advising Cory Booker when he runs for president. You know, that means she can't, that means she can't say certain things that she otherwise would.
Right. And I think they, as a team, I mean, if the show's going to work, you know, they're all going to have to be on the same page what kind of show that they want and what kind of vibe they want to give. And, you know, part of that's going to be practice. I mean, a lot of times these shows get judged on their first edition, and that's not really fair. You need some time to kind of build up a group chemistry. But they also, if they're just going to come at the whole show from completely different angles, then it's going to be more awkward and stilted show. So we'll see if they found a way to solve the problems from where Crossfire went before, because I think people don't have a problem with interesting debate. They have a problem with everybody just yelling at each other and repeating talking points over and over again and not actually advancing any, not getting in deep into where the issues really lie.
Yeah, and this goes to the whole, like, Jon Stewart criticism of Crossfire, which I think was overblown and ridiculous. There are a lot of, you know, his indictment of Crossfire is really an indictment of cable news in general.
I think it's what he was going for.
What's that?
I think it's exactly what he was going for. I don't think he was, I mean, he was sort of treating Crossfire as sort of the worst of the worst, but I think he was making that broader critique about how the business had degraded.
Well, Crossfire has the unfortunate name, unfortunate in the sense that it's easy to shoot down if you're Jon Stewart, that obviously pits from the left. I'm, you know, we used to do that, Bill. From the right, I'm Matt Lewis. From the left, I'm Bill Scherr. We had fun with that here for a year or two. And so they set it up as this, you know, Manichaean struggle or whatever, this very stark struggle when ideas are obviously sometimes much more nuanced. But look, I think Crossfire is, you know, probably will be and certainly was one of the better political cable shows. And I'm excited. I'm happy it's coming back. And I just, you know, wait for the day when it's, you know, when we're part of it.
Well, to show them what they're missing. So you had a very interesting piece at the week this week, in regards to what's driving the opponents of immigration reform, and you seem a little unsettled with what you discovered.
Yes. Well, let me tell the story. My colleague, Mickey Kaus, and of course, a prominent blogging head as well, opposes immigration reform. And I think he has completely legitimate reasons for doing so. He and I have debated this on my podcast. And his argument is basically he cares about American workers, working class folks, and they're already struggling economically with the unemployment rate, and then bringing in immigrants certainly, you know, you could argue would hurt them. And I think that's I disagree with this point, but it's a completely legitimate point. Unfortunately, not all of his supporters have such noble reasons for opposing this. And Mickey urged his supporters to create videos opposing amnesty. And the first video, which I dissected at the Daily Caller, demonstrated that that this one person, and I do not want to conflate, I do not want to suggest that this is a majority opinion. It is not. But there is a strain amongst the opponents of immigration reform that was represented here. And essentially, this person argued that white people are uniquely suited to freedom and democracy. And I was shocked when I pushed back against that, because I do believe we need to preserve the values of Western civilization, and we need to preserve the rule of law, and we need to preserve, you know, America needs to be a virtuous place. But I think that has absolutely nothing to do with skin pigmentation. And I was shocked to learn how many people disagree with me. And these are, if you look at my piece at the week, I quote a couple of them. These are intelligent people, Bill. These are not rubes. These are very clearly intelligent people who have a worldview which says that white people are uniquely suited to freedom and democracy, And that is their reason for opposing this. And this is not a majority opinion. Do not get me wrong. I do not want anybody to think that. This is a minority opinion, but it is not an anomaly either. It represents a certain strain of thought in the anti-immigration reform movement. And I was alarmed to see how prevalent it was, and I wrote about it. And I find it disturbing.
So what's the reaction been? Are they totally in your business now?
I'm shocked to see people, and these are, you know, look, anybody, remember the whole John Derbyshire scandal at National Review? I mean, nobody prominent, there are no prominent commentators who will cop to this worldview. And I don't know if that's because they don't believe it or they know better than to cop to this worldview. And let me just again state, this is a minority view. The vast majority of people who oppose immigration reform, there are plenty of legitimate reasons to oppose this specific bill. And I think Mickey, as I said, has an entirely defensible position. But I do suspect that there are a lot of people out there, and I've heard, you know, anecdotally, I've got emails from people who read the post, tweets from people who are openly saying this. There was one guy who I just posted it in my Daily Caller blog just this morning after I published my piece of the week. This guy says, you know, Matt Lewis needs to be schooled on how, you know, the importance of European character and in a free society. And I tweeted back saying, look, of course I believe the value, you know, Western civilization is important. It started in 1215 with the signing of the Magna Carta. I mean, we didn't develop our political institutions overnight, but that has nothing to do with skin pigmentation. It's about ideas. And he tweeted back, what do you think Western civilization is? So clearly he's saying that, Western civilization and being white are essentially one and the same. One person who I quote in my piece of the week said that said that whites are genetically, or that some people aren't genetically prepared, he essentially said that these things are genetically determined, which I find horrific, and I'm shocked that people who are, you know, clearly intelligent, you can tell by their writing, are advancing this worldview here in the 21st century. I think it's entirely defensible to say that I'm worried about assimilation and that folks coming in here who've been living in socialist countries may come from a culture that we're going to have a problem with assimilation. That's, you know, I may disagree, but I think it's an entirely legitimate point. But the notion that it has anything to do with genetics is alarming to me. I wrote about it. I think some people wish I hadn't written about it. But I think as a conservative, or just as a human being, I mean, it is incumbent upon us to call this thing out when we see it. And I want to be on the record. I want to be on the record saying that this is not only dangerous, but frankly wrong, is incorrect. And I do not think it represents a majority opinion, but I think it is alarming that it's out there.
Just quick breaking news, Matt. Just I think you want to know. I'm seeing on SCOTUS blog. DOMA is unconstitutional as a deprivation of the equal liberty of persons that was protected by the Fifth Amendment.
Read that again, Bill.
Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional as a deprivation of the equal liberty of persons as protected by the Fifth Amendment. That is from SCOTUS blog.
Interesting.
5-4 Kennedy in the majority.
My initial reaction, and this is always dangerous to give, you know, we could have been doing this during the Obamacare decision and when it was wrongly reported. But I thought that it would be struck down by more like a Tenth Amendment thing, that you would have people like Scalia arguing that it was unconstitutional because the states should, for federalist reasons, because the states should be determining marriage. So I am, I'm not surprised by that decision, Bill. I am surprised based on what you read, that was the reason.
It says, DOMA singles out a class of persons deemed by a state entitled to recognition and protection to enhance their own liberty. That appears to be a quote from the opinion. So we can talk about that more. I don't want to get you off of immigration, but I just thought you'd want to know.
Yeah, well, thanks for telling me. And frankly, I think I've said, I mean, I think I've said all I need to say about it. but what do you, what's,
I want to ask
what,
you, but,
what's your take on that, Bill?
Oh, on DOMA or immigration?
Whatever you want to talk about.
Well, I'll give it to immigration. I mean, everything you're saying, like, I don't think anyone on the left is as shocked. I mean, I think liberals tend to presume racism on the right more than they should. So that doesn't, fairly or unfairly, it's not going to be shocking to the left. I guess, what do you think, what should the right do about that? I mean, should this change how Boehner treats this? Should there be more fear? I mean, I know you're saying that's not a majority view on the anti-immigration side, but to what degree is it an albatross that the Republican Party has to shake off? And should Boehner take that into account as he gets a Senate bill that's likely to have a 70-vote majority, supermajority? Should be saying to himself, this view is out there, and if I stuff this bill, that we're going to be associated with that racist, white supremacist view?
So, I think that, I don't think this should factor in to whether or not Republicans should vote for the bill. I think that Republicans and conservatives need to confront this intellectually, though. I think if you're a conservative, it's in your best interest to ignore this. And frankly, that's probably why my story, there's a lot of news this week. And I apologize for my throat condition today. There's a lot of news this week crowding everything out, a lot of news. But this story hasn't really caught fire, and I think it's because liberals aren't surprised. And I think conservatives, it's not in their best interest to admit that there is this element out there, but they exist, as I've discovered. I was shocked to find out how prevalent this was. And again, we're still talking about a small percentage, but it's out there. But I do think that we need to acknowledge that it exists, and I think we need to confront it. Because conservatism, as Reverend Sammy Rodriguez is his name, said at the Faith and Freedom Conference, conservatism is not about conserving pigmentation, it's about ideas. And I think that's true. And I think it's entirely defensible to say we need to have, you know, if you go back to, you know, Burkean conservatism is about conserving tradition and culture, and I do think it's completely legitimate to worry about assimilation and preserving political institutions and the American way of life. I think that's entirely fine, and that's in no way racist. But when you start saying, yeah, but I'm really worried about whites losing the majority, and I don't think other people are capable of preserving freedom or living, enjoying freedom, that is not only wrong, but abhorrent. And conservatives and Republicans simply, you know, ought not be tagged with that. And as much as it's a vast minority viewpoint and also political death. So I think it's important to push back against this, and that's what I'm trying to do. And I'm probably not winning a lot of friends by doing it, but as I said earlier, Bill, in our discussion about Crossfire, I crossed the Rubicon at some point, and I said, "Why would anybody read me or pay me?" And one of the only reasons would be that I'm willing to tell the truth and to and to confront uncomfortable things. And that's what I tried to do here with this piece.
No, I wonder, you know, we haven't heard a lot of open racist talk in this debate. You know, the criticism has been more about, you know, border security, preferring legal immigration versus illegal immigration, some degree about jobs, but you know, since the unions have been largely favorable to the bill, and there are certain side issues that they've been pushing, but they haven't made a broad based lambasting of the bill, say it's going to take our jobs or things like that. But it seems like as the Senate negotiators are trying to piece together a supermajority, yeah, they're trying to address each one of these potential weak spots. I mean, the basic, so you have an arduous path to citizenship, so you can't say it's a straight up amnesty. There's a punishment involved before getting citizenship, going forward, they're trying to improve the flow of immigration, so it's easier to be legal, and there's less of a need to cross the border illegally. And now they've accepted this border surge, where they have this massive infusion of cash because they had such good deficit numbers from the CBO, they were freed up to throw more money at the problem and say, okay, we're going to double the border patrol, we're going to build the wall end to end. It's a total of $46 billion. It was going to be $8 billion, now it's $46 billion, so it's a huge jump in how much money they're putting into it. So it's very hard to say that you're not doing all you can on that front. And I think the left is accepting this because, I mean, so long as those who are here have some kind of feasible path to citizenship, and as long as there is a relatively easy way to get in for legitimate reasons, then who cares if you got a whole bunch of border patrol, if the border is militarized? I mean, so what? If you can still get in, who cares? So it seems to appease everyone who has a reasonable concern about how this goes forward. And so once you address all those reasonable concerns, well, what concerns are left but the racist ones? So are you going to hear more and more of this now because there's no other way to go without sounding like an idiot? I mean, you're going to sound like an idiot either way, you can't complain about where's the border security when you've just doubled the border patrol, you know?
Right. Well, and the funny thing is, it is clear that there are people who just oppose this for whatever reason, and it doesn't have to be racist. They just oppose this, but then they try to get into the weeds of the bill to criticize it. But it's merely a ploy, so they're not really concerned about making the bill better. So, for example, with this Cornyn Amendment. And the Cornyn Amendment said that there would be a trigger where you had to apprehend 90% of the people attempting to come into the United States, something like that.
Right.
And this was attacked as a fig leaf, and this isn't real border security. It's not really going to do anything, you know. And so then they changed it to the Corker-Hogan Amendment, which you're talking about, which passed,
right,
which is like 700 miles of border fence. It gave them everything they want. If you're a critic of, if you're saying that the Cornyn Amendment isn't tough, it gave them all, you know, basically everything that they, you know, like doubled or tripled.
And then some.
Yeah, just, and you know, tons of like border security, the fence, all that. And the very people who were attacking the Cornyn Amendment now started attacking, they were attacking the Cornyn Amendment, you know, on a dime turned and started attacking the Corker-Hogan Amendment, saying it should have been more like the Cornyn Amendment.
And then the Cornyn Amendment had less border security. I mean, and Cornyn himself was like, you guys told me that my 5,000 border agents were too much, we didn't need it, now you come here with 25,000? It's like, dude, you won, so why don't you just vote for it? Like, I'm sorry that made you look bad, but so what? You won the argument beyond what you ever hoped for. Claim victory and move on, but it exposes the fact that perhaps he didn't really want to win. He wanted to kill it.
Well, so many of the people who are criticizing the bill vociferously are looking for reasons to be against it, is the point. And they will get into the weeds and pick apart little things in the bill. But it's once that's fixed, they will move on to the next, you know, thing. They have ulterior motives. It's concern trolling, essentially, is what I'm saying.
Right. So with all this, with all the legitimate criticisms addressed, with the bill being on track to get a big vote in the Senate, but you're getting pushback from the House. You have a story in the Times today saying there's no way they're gonna the House will be compelled to take it up if it only has a minority of Republicans supporting in the Senate, even though it's going to be a 70-vote majority most likely. They're still talking about having majority of the majority support in the House, which would make it unlikely to even see the floor. What kind of backlash would that result in if the House just stuffs it? And Schumer was saying on one of the Sunday talk shows, like, there's going to be a million people on the Mall if you have a bill that has clear public support, clear bipartisan support, and you just bury it. You know, folks aren't going to stand for that. What I would point out is, we have evidence of this. There were massive protests in 2006 when the House conservatives pushed through a very anti-immigrant bill and the Senate was considering it, and Latino groups, poured into the streets. It was a huge display of grassroots strength, very unusual, because protests happen in the world. They don't usually actually get the Senate to change their position. And they actually spooked Republicans, saying, wait a second, these are actual voters here. It's not just the illegal immigrants that can't vote. They got friends and family that do vote. And maybe we should, back off of this. So I could very well see that kind of development happen again. And with the Republican leadership so worried about, as much as these racist folks that you're mentioning worried about the day when whites are no longer majority, that's happening, either with or without this bill.
Yeah, and if you don't like that, start having more kids.
Start having babies or flee to some sort of all-white, Scandinavian paradise.
There's an easy way to rectify this problem. And look, I think we need more people. I'm up with people, Bill. That's part of the reason
I'm
for immigration reform. We need more people.
in all likelihood, look, we're not going to be a majority white country, in the next couple decades. That's just the most likely outcome. We already have a non-white president. Democracy still stands. Maybe some folks on the right don't agree, but I think most people say democracy still stands. To put all on this bill is just idiotic and mushy-headed thinking.
Let me say, I think that it will pass the Senate comfortably. I do not see it passing the House. I don't know how it's going to go down, if it just won't be brought up, if they'll just try to pass a different...
And who would face the blame at that point? Do you think it would all fall on Republicans, or would Latinos also blame Obama? You said you'd get this through and it didn't get through. You're the guy at the top, so you suffer. Does everybody lose?
Or if all the ducks
were lined up and Boehner stuffs it, Boehner, the Republicans lose?
The only way this passes, in my opinion, is if Boehner decides that he wants this legacy where he's beloved by the mainstream media, and he teams with Democrats to pass this. But, and so in other words, he throws out the Hastert rule. But I say that's highly unlikely. My guess is I don't think this thing passes the House. Because if you look at the incentives bill, this is just people responding to incentives. I mean, if you're looking at an entire state or the national level, you have an entirely different incentive than if you represent a random district somewhere that's gerrymandered. We've gerrymandered our districts so that there are all these safe Democratic seats and safe Republican seats. And so, what's in the best interest, collectively of the Republican Party or of the nation may not be what's in the best interest of Congressman Smith from, you know, Iowa or whatever. And so I do not see this passing the House. And I think that Republicans will be blamed for it. And here's the ironic part. I bet you that there will be people, a lot of people, who will blame Rubio because they will follow this logic, okay? They will say that Republicans look bad because immigration got shut down. And it's Rubio's fault for putting them in this position to look bad. So it's not the people who killed reform who will be blamed. It'll be Rubio who could be blamed for this, which is sort of like blaming the victim in some ways, but I'm confident that the question is how many people come to this conclusion, but it's going to happen. It's already started to happen.
I also wonder if Rubio is starting to lose the credit for getting it done at all. He hasn't been the linchpin in the last few days. You know, his attempts to cobble together a border security amendment didn't work. He was working with Cornyn. And his idea to have Congress be the final arbiter when the trigger has been achieved was rejected by the rest of the Gang of Eight and picked up by Rand Paul and was defeated. It was Corker and Hoven that stepped up and working with Schumer. And I feel Schumer's getting the victory lap right now.
Well, this is the real concern on the right. There is this notion that Schumer is this puppet master and that Rubio is this like Pollyanna, you know, who just is being totally manipulated. I mean, I think Schumer's a smart politician, don't get me wrong, but the right has really inflated him as this, you know, almost godlike figure who, devious, you know, sort of godlike figure who is pulling all the strings, and Republicans are completely being manipulated by him. They have this almost like inferiority complex about it.
I think Schumer's are perfectly happy to share the credit and not have this be seen as a Democrat bill and not a bipartisan bill. I mean, they seem quite eager to be playing up McCain and Graham for a long time. I think he's having to play up Rubio, but Rubio sort of has gone off on his own path. And how much of that is him freelancing, how much of this is staged kabuki, I don't know. But he's trying to position himself, Rubio, as sort of not being fully in until other conservatives come on board, which I think was a reasonable approach to take to try to get maximum support. But just the specific way that he did it didn't work. He just legislatively, he didn't come up with a creative enough idea. And some deference to him, the idea could not have materialized until that CBO report came in and money was freed up. But he wasn't the one that took advantage of that moment.
There's also just, I think that the main reason that the House won't pass this is the differing incentives that they have. But there's also just, you know, ranked politics. I mean, why do we want to hand, Obama is having all these problems. You know, there's a recent Fox News poll yesterday that had his approval rating plummeting, even among Democrats. Why hand him some, you know, legacy of passing, you know, immigration reform? And why do it when he can sign it? You know, couldn't Republicans get a better deal in 3 years when they have a Republican president? I mean, again, I'm not saying I buy into this theory, but I think that there, you know, these are some arguments that Republicans are thinking when, you know, in the House. So I don't see it passing.
I totally get your point about the gerrymandered districts and the House conservatives don't have any direct incentive. You know, they don't have enough Latinos in their districts. They're going to win they got to fit enough primary challenges from the right, not appease the middle. But the Republican leadership, the Republican, the RNC, those who want the party to be nationally competitive again, they do have an interest in this. And don't they have leverage over Boehner to say, you got to take one for the team here, or else the whole party's going to go down for the next decade.
I mean, I don't think so. I think that Boehner gets to make his own decisions, but again, Boehner would have to choose, like, you know, there are 435 members of Congress, and, you know, I mean, Boehner would have to, I think to pass this, Boehner would have to essentially do it with majority Democrat support. And there would be, I mean, you would probably see him ousted as Speaker if he did that. And so, does he want, you know...
But he has broken Hastert rule before. He put the fiscal cliff deal on the floor without majority of the majority. Put the Violence Against Women Act expansion to cover gays more without majority of the majority. I don't remember if the debt ceiling suspension in February was majority of majority or not.
That's child's play. Child's play compared to this bill. This would be nuclear.
But with an issue that clearly.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I have a hard time. I'm not saying you're wrong. I would just think that having the leading lights of the party saying, "Look, you can rail against this, you can still vote against it, you can run against us in your district, we don't care, but let's lay off of Boehner because he's doing this for the long term benefit of the party, so we can win back the West of 2016." You don't think that wouldn't quell a speaker revolt?
No, I don't think so. I think that. All hell would break loose if Boehner passes the Senate, you know, say the Senate bill, obviously would go to conference. But if something resembling the Senate bill passes the House and Boehner does it by, you know, teaming with the majority Democrats, I think all hell would break loose and it would be really off the hinges. I mean, this is such an animating issue for a lot of Republican activists. Look at the Heritage, you know, Heritage Action, you know. I think, you know, the pushback that would come from Ann Coulter and Rush Limbaugh and, you know, the activist right and you know, Heritage would be unbelievable. And I think you would see Boehner pushed aside. I could be wrong, but that's my. If I had to bet, I think that would happen.
So assuming this doesn't go through the House, Boehner doesn't put his speakership on the line, it dies in the House. I know you agree this is probably bad for the party long term. Is it bad for the party 2014, or because of the gerrymandering and such that there's no 2014 risk for Republicans to bury this?
I don't. Like, there is an argument that Democrats can nationalize the 2014 elections. I don't see it happening. I think that 2014 will look more like 2010 than 2012. And that's just a product of midterm elections being low turnout. They tend to go against the party in power. Obama, as I said before, is losing popularity. And the districts are gerrymandered. And so I think this is a much bigger problem long term and nationally. It's not that big of a problem in the immediately and at the state and local level. So, yeah, there'll be talk about how this is going to be used against Republicans. To drive turnout, minority turnout in 2014. I'm not terribly concerned about that. I'm much more concerned about the long-term ramifications of this. And I think that here's the danger. I mean, the danger is that Republicans lose Hispanics the way they have lost blacks. As you know, African Americans vote 95%. Or something Democratic. If Republicans and Republicans lost more than 70% of the Hispanic vote last time, and at some point, that becomes untenable politically. There just won't be enough. I mean, the Republican Party cannot be the party of white people. it shouldn't be. And not only is it not, you know, good to be the party solely of white people, but as you know, at some point, the math doesn't work. Even under the best circumstances, the math doesn't work. So long-term, this is a huge problem for Republicans, and I suspect that this will go down in the House and that Republicans will be blamed for it, and that they will lose what you don't want to happen is you don't want a situation where it is where it is culturally unacceptable to say I'm Hispanic and I'm Republican. You cannot have a situation where it's you know sort of unacceptable for that to happen. And I mean, right now, if you look at the elected officials, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Susana Martinez, Brian Sandoval, I mean, there's some very, you know, prominent Hispanics, Hispanic Republicans out there, and this should give Republicans hope. But you know, symbolism really matters, and I think they should be very concerned about this.
So the other issue that happened this week that could have 2014 impact is climate. So Obama gives a big climate speech. It gets overshadowed by Supreme Court. It's overshadowed by the Snowden chase. So I don't think it's outside of those who are in the environmental community and those on the right who are sworn enemies of the environmental community. People aren't paying too close attention. But this is a very sensitive subject in a lot of swing state areas, particularly coal state areas, you know, Obama's trying to walk a very fine line in saying we need to act. You know, clock's ticking on us. We don't have the luxury of time to twiddle our thumbs here. Congress isn't going to move. I can't have a negotiated bipartisan agreement on this like with immigration. But I have legal authority with the EPA and we got to move. But he hasn't spelled out exactly what the rule might be. I think there's still an expectation this is going to be negotiated with. Because it's about targeting power plants. I think power plants could well be at the table negotiating the outlines of what this rule might look like. They were fairly amenable to the cap and trade bill, more so than the coal industry and the oil industry. But if coal does a total freak out on this, might that help Republicans in 2014? Or even in 2016, if it really goes haywire, and make any rule that comes out of Obama null and void by 2017. But I just want to ask you more about the 2014 politics. Do you think this is a sleeper issue? Even if you agree with what Obama's doing, if you're on the left, should you be worried that Obama's going to throw away the Senate by diving in headlong on this?
Well, I hate to disappoint you again. I think this is more of a long-term issue. We hear about this war on coal. We saw Joe Manchin, senator from West Virginia, being very critical of the administration recently. but the interesting thing is, this Sean Trendy over at Real Clear Politics wrote a piece, and this ties into our last conversation, but he wrote a piece saying that Republicans are going to have to choose between being between going toward working class whites or what I call cosmopolitan conservatives and Hispanics. And there is an argument that says that there is an opening, an unexploited niche of sort of populist, a sort of populist niche that Rick Santorum sort of failed to fill. But kind of a Mike Huckabee, Ross Perot voter out there. And the truth is, if you look at the numbers, Mitt Romney probably, you know, Mitt Romney didn't lose because of the Hispanic vote. A much bigger concern for him was that working class whites, as I predicted months, maybe years in advance, for some reason working class whites just weren't into Mitt Romney. Now, we can wonder why that would be. Maybe because, as Mike Huckabee, to paraphrase Mike Huckabee, he reminded them of the man who fired their father, not their father. But in any event, there is an argument that says the Republican Party ought to go populist. And this, you know, you're gonna win Ohio. That is the bellwether state. The Republican Party needs to be the party of working class whites. Get them to turn out in bigger numbers. Certainly, they could go talk about the coal industry and sort of be the party for that guy, that working class guy, who, by the way, is losing as the manufacturing industry has crumbled, is losing prestige. He's losing prestige in his own home. I just had on my podcast the author of the book Men on Strike. So there's gender issues involved here. There's cultural issues. There are working class whites have lost their identity in this country. They used to be able to get a job in manufacturing without a college degree and provide a good middle class living. And now you have the Obama administration, on top of everything else, all the other struggles, attacking the coal industry. So, you know, then there's another argument that says, well, okay, maybe this is a niche that's unexploited, and you could cobble together a coalition for the short term, but it's eventually, like within the next generation, that's going to be a minority. You couldn't win with that coalition anyway, and you're basically creating a know-nothing party, you know, that would die out. So it's a huge discussion. Honestly, I think the environmental stuff is interesting as much as it's part of this larger discussion. I actually think that there is a third way. Trendy sort of sets this up as a, this or that. Argument. I think that Republicans can find a way to appeal to, you know, working class folks, and also reach out to more urban work, you know, urban cosmopolitan, college educated, and ethnic Americans as well. But they need to thread that needle.
I certainly it would make I think a lot more sense for Republicans to start talking about ways to combat global warming and as opposed to denying it. We're probably not there yet, but
let me just say, I know I filibustered there, but you make a point, because if they decide to go toward the more cosmopolitan, conservative, urban angle, they would probably their rhetoric would be accepting of climate change, at least. Right. If they decide to go the populist route, then I think you demagogue it and attack it as, you know, job killing and elitist and effete and all that. Either way, you could still oppose cap and trade either way or whatever. But I think the way you talk about those issues, it depends on which group of voters you're trying to appeal to.
And I think there's an opportunity here if Republicans want to take, I think, the more enlightened path. I mean, the reason why Obama is doing this through the EPA is that the obvious presumption, which is well-founded, that you can't get anything through Congress right now. You know, they tried even when Democrats were in control, and you still couldn't get the supermajority in Congress because the Democrats from coal states are hesitant on this stuff too. So it's a heavy bar. It's a high bar to clear to get this kind of legislation passed. But the value of doing it through Congress is that Congress has purse strings. And the EPA doesn't. So you do it through Congress, you can give out cash to affected industry sectors to help them deal with the transition. And the EPA cannot do that. The EPA has the legal authority to regulate, but they don't have the legal authority to give out some sugar with the medicine. Now that it's going to be, if it's presumed that the regulation is coming, it is going to happen. They're going to do it in a meticulous way that's going to withstand legal challenge. They're going to get buy-in from the power plant industry, perhaps, so there's not going to be a furious pushback. The Congress is not going to be able to overrule it because the Democrats in the Senate won't allow that to happen. And it's going to be too burdensome in 2017 to try to undo it once it's actually locked in place, because there'll be a whole legal procedure you'd have to go through to undo it. So if you're coming at it from the perspective of it's going to happen anyway, a Republican could say, since this is on the horizon, why don't we go back to the negotiating table and come up with a way that's going to go easier on corporations than the regulatory route? If you're open to talking, we're open to talk too. I think they have an opportunity to do that. Probably not going to happen today, but I think perhaps if oil, if coal, if agribusiness, if some of the more recalcitrant power companies say, look, Republicans, we give you lots of money, it's going to be better for us. We're going to have more certainty if you negotiate a deal with Democrats now than what we're going through with the EPA. We would prefer it.
Well, I know this maybe fits very well into your liberal fascism, though.
Your idea of
tying politics and business together and buying off votes. I kid. They should, the administration should bring you in to the meetings.
Well, I'm not saying they don't already know. I mean, I think they are not hopeful that corporations are going to come around, but I mean, that's just the reality of the situation. If you're a corporation and you don't like what's coming down from the EPA, your recourse, I mean, unless you think you can completely overhaul Congress, completely overhaul the White House and just bury everything, the other recourse is to cut a deal. That's all you got left.
Well, my voice doesn't have much left, Bill. So
okay.
That's all I got left.
Okay. Well, we'll call it a week. Check out what Matt has to say on theweek.com and immigration. Very interesting stuff.
Thank you. Good talking to you.
And we'll see you next week on the Here in the DMZ.
You got it. Ciao.